Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Rising Radio, Sinoland, and I am incredibly honored and humbled to have on the show today an incredibly well-informed an incredibly well-informed individual. That's Alex Craner. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm doing very well, Jeff. Thank you for having me, and warm greetings to your viewers and listeners.
The Alex, I saw Alex on another video. He was a guest on another video program, and I was so impressed with him that I reached out to him. And let me read you his bio, and you will see why all of us are going to be very glad to hear what he has to say. Alex is the founder of Craner Analytics and creator of iSystem Trend Following. He has worked as a market analyst, researcher, trader, and hedge fund manager since 1996. Alex was born and raised in a socialist regime of former Yugoslavia under one-party communist rule. As a 17-year-old, he joined a student exchange program and took up his university studies there, ultimately transferring to Switzerland on a scholarship where he completed a degree in business and economics. From Switzerland, his path led him to Venezuela, my God, where he lived for a year and experienced his first banking crisis in 1994 when nine of Venezuela's 16 largest banks failed and brought the country's economy to a grinding halt. The same year, he returned to Croatia and joined the military, where he served through 1995 during the last phases of Croatia's War of Independence. In 1996, upon discharge from the military, Alex took employment at an oil trading company in Monaco. In 1998, he became the head of risk and CEO in 2000. Alex had originated the firm's research and development program in market analysis and application of neural networks and artificial intelligence in trading and financial and commodities markets. By 2007, Alex launched his own investment management business and was among the small minority of managers who generated positive investment returns, plus 27% during the 2008 financial crisis. Over the following 6 years, his fund outperformed the Dow Jones Credit Suisse Index of Blue Chip Commodity Futures Trading Funds. Unbelievable. In 2011, Alex joined Lee Robinson's Altana Wealth to manage the firm's inflation hedge strategy. In 2019, Alex created Altana Wealth's systematic portfolio allocation strategy designed to bridge the gap between technology and finance. In more recent years, Alex also busied himself as an author. He published his first book, Mastering Uncertainty in Commodities Trading, in 2015. In 2021, this book was selected as number one on financialexpert.co.uk's list of the five best commodities books for investors and traders. Congratulations. In 2017, he published The Grand Deception, which is available exclusively from the Red Pill Press. In 2021, he published Alex Craner's Trends Following Bible. Unbelievable. I am so impressed, Alex. Well, thank you for being on the show. And
Thank you very much, Jeff. That's very kind of you to say.
Alex is in Croatia and I am in France, and so we are European buddies already. Let's go ahead and get started right away, because it's not very often we get a guy like Alex on the show who understands finance. We all know finance is wonderful when you need to buy a car or buy a house, or you need capital for your business, or your government needs money, for infrastructure or whatever. But there's also the dark side, usury, the City of London, and color revolutions and fomenting war for profit. So there's the two sides. So I'm really happy to have Alex to help us. My first question: most people do not understand, at least I don't, how someone like George Soros could crash the British pound in 1992. I also know that when French President François Mitterrand was elected in 1981, There were maneuvers by the City of London and Wall Street to put pressure on the French economy to sabotage his socialist policies. We can also mention the financial raids on the Asian Tigers in 1997 and Japan in 1988. So my question is, how do the City of London and Wall Street go about doing this, bringing down currencies and economies? It seems a real contradiction to the country's sovereignty. And then I'll have a follow-up question when you finish answering that one, Alex. Take it away, my friend.
Okay, so where do we start? From George Soros. That's that episode. What was that? 17 September 1992. We're going 32 years ago about. George Soros crashed the British pound. Now, there's a lot of background to that. British pound at that time was, we didn't have the euro yet. What we had was an exchange rate mechanism where European Union member countries agreed to fix their exchange rates one against the other in a relatively narrow band. Because the strongest currency in Europe was Deutschmark, this was all expressed in the Deutschmarks. So the British pound was supposed to be between, I think, 2.9 Deutschmarks and 3.1 or 3.15, I forget. And as it turned out, when they this was John Major's brainchild. Joining of the ERM was John Major's political ace card. As it turned out, that particular exchange rate effectively overvalued the British pound. And so things were going okay until in 1992, recession hit, and you had unemployment rate jump in Britain from, I don't know, from like 8 or 9% to 12%. It was the economy was in a recession, and so there was a great deal of political pressure to either devalue the pound or to just get out of the exchange rate mechanism, ERM. And I'm not exactly sure how the thing played out because there were statements by officials of the Bundesbank in Germany that kind of suggested that something was going on. The Bundesbank officials were talking about increasing the interest rate on the Deutsche Bank. I'm sorry, on the Deutschmark, on the German mark. And so somehow the financial markets came to the conclusion that this should put pressure on the British pound, which, to be honest, I don't quite understand this. If the Germans were increasing, no, sorry, they were going to cut the interest rate. They were going to cut the interest rate on the German mark because there was recession in Germany as well. So that would have reduced the exchange rate value of the Deutschmark, but that would increase the exchange rate value of the British pound. Anyway, one thing led to another, and the financial markets kind of got into this frame of mind that the British pound had to be devalued. And so they started to bet against it. And George Soros's Quantum Fund, by early September of 92, they had about a billion pounds or $1 billion, I don't know, a bet against the British pound. And then, for some reason, George Soros decided to aggressively bet against the British pound. So they through the m march of through the month of September 92, Soros had his traders increase their bet against the British pound to something like $15 billion. And so they had a very massive bet against the pound. And they weren't the only ones, because there was also other hedge funds and large banks who were all betting against the pound. So it was a massive position that piled up against the British pound. And so on this fateful day, which was Wednesday, the Black Wednesday, September 17th, 1992, the pound started going down. And Soros and others just kept piling in against the pound. And at the same time, the British government and the Bank of England tried to defend the pound. And in the end, they spent something like $27 billion buying the pound to try to keep its exchange rate stable at around 2.9 Deutschmarks. And it didn't work. Nothing helped. It was just going down. And then John Major's government, what was the Chancellor of Exchequer, was Lamont. I forget his first name. Doesn't matter. They decided to increase the interest rate from 8% to 12% first. That was in the morning of that day. Nothing happened. The pound kept collapsing. And then by the afternoon, they increased the interest rate another 300 basis points to 15%. And
In one day,
also,
in
in
one day.
one day, yes, absolutely spectacular.
Unbelievable.
All told, the pound lost about 25% of its exchange value. It declined from 2.9 pound to the Deutschmark to 2.4 pounds to the, sorry, 2.9 Deutschmarks to the pound to 2.4 Deutschmarks to the pound.
Wow.
It was pretty much the exacerbated the recession, because when your economy is in a recession and you yank the interest rate up to 15% in one day,
That's not very
that's, yeah,
helpful.
exactly, that's going to push a lot of people into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And this did happen. A lot of people went into bankruptcy. It very much exacerbated the economic crisis in Britain. It lost a massive amount of foreign exchange for the Bank of England, for the British government. And in the end, George Soros walked away with something like $1 billion in profits, or $2 billion. It's not exactly clear. Now, how could this happen? That's a good question, because the way it was sold to us through the media, they tried to build George Soros into this larger than life financial genius. I believe that he knew ahead of time what was going to go down. The officials at the Bundesbank and at the Bank of England and the Exchequer all kind of signaled the weakness of the pound, that a devaluation was pretty much inevitable. Everybody knew, everybody was ready to jump in on that trade. George Soros and whoever was backing him were in that trade already early, and somehow he knew to go very, very aggressive. So, until that day, they were comfortable with the $1 billion position against the pound, and then all of a sudden they went 15 times higher. Yeah, that's not genius. That's knowing something that others didn't know. That's like having inside information.
Yeah.
Now, there are reasons to believe that George Soros was very close with people like Jacob Rothschild
Yeah.
and
I was going to
Sir.
ask you about that.
So there's no doubt that they cooperated on various things in the past, and that they, or maybe it was over time, we know that they cooperated closely. Sir, I forget his first name, Goldsmith,
Yeah, I know who you're
was
talking
in
about.
on it, as well as were some other sharpshooters from the City of London. And so I think it was, okay, granted, Britain was in a recession. Granted, the British pound may have been overvalued. Granted, a typical government move in that at that point would be to devalue your currency by decree or by some kind of intervention. Simply, your exports are uncompetitive. So what do? You devalue you devalue your currency. And then all of a sudden your current account starts improving because you start importing less because imports become more expensive, and you start exporting more because your exports become more competitive. So all that is good, and governments around the world routinely do that. Only, for a major Western government, that's seen as a major sign of weakness because, Western nations like particularly Britain and the United States, they swear by free markets and by non-intervention, and government can't have anything to do with this, and so on. And so I think they orchestrated the devaluation of the British currency for one reason, to improve the current account, to let's say, try to get Britain out of recession, except, government went the way of increasing the interest rate, so they made that worse. But also to get rid of the euro, and to discourage British governments for ever considering joining the euro. So at that point,
It worked.
at the end of the day, the secretary, the Minister of the Exchequer, Lamont, not only announced the 15% interest rate, he also announced that Britain was getting out of the exchange rate mechanism. And so that was where we're going to manage our currency by ourselves. We're not entering into exchange rate mechanism or a common currency. So that way, the British managed to preserve their financial sovereignty, and not allow themselves to have their currency ruled by the European Central Bank. But clearly, it was a manipulation by a high cabal, to use Winston Churchill's terminology.
Amazing. Well, let me that brings us, what controls would a country need in order to prevent this from happening? Is this one of the reasons why China has not been attacked? I mean, does it have in certain policies in place that keep it from being raided? What's going on?
Yes, China does. Well, China has a dual circulation. They have a currency, a different circulation for foreign trade, and they have a different circulation for domestic exchange, right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so it's not a different currency. It's the same currency. It's just two differently managed systems. Right. And so that they can control that one doesn't spill into the other, or that one doesn't drain the other. So that, when the financial crisis happened in East Asia in 1997, it toppled all of the tiger economies, except for China, because China basically insulated their domestic economy from the risk of foreign investors pulling out the money from China and draining the liquidity from their economy. And all the other countries that didn't have that defense, that didn't have that dual circulation, they were basically left hung out to dry.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
And also China just, went right through 1988 with Japan. And I wrote an article recently. I think the last recession, they haven't had a recession in like 40 something years. So I don't know what it is that they're, I don't know what it is that of course they print their own money and don't borrow from private banks. But obviously what they, why don't other countries adopt what China's doing? I mean, if it's so successful.
Jeff, I wrote an article about that also recently, and I posed exactly those questions. I'm not sure if it's on my Substack because I have another daily newsletter that's for subscribers only. But I basically posed the question, So China hasn't had a financial crisis in over 40 years, at least not system-wide. There's individual sectors of the economy, like real estate now, that has hit a snag, but it hasn't imploded the whole of economy. It hasn't pushed the economy into a recession. And then you also have the same in Russia. Russia hasn't had a financial crisis since Vladimir Putin has been in power, which is 25 years almost. And so, I said, why don't we ask themselves what they are doing different rather than always piling on them, the then
Oh,
communist and the tyrant?
I did read that. That's the one where you talked about how when you were growing up in Yugoslavia, the article that you wrote in you about when you were growing up in Yugoslavia and how safe it was. And is that the article that you're talking about?
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure which article that was. I honestly, I don't remember. Like once the article is published, it recedes into the
Next.
fog. Yes, exactly. So I don't know, but I don't have all the answers. I'm trying to understand these things, but I said, people who are experts, people who are in charge of our economic systems in of our monetary and financial systems. Why don't they study what the Russians and the Chinese got right rather than condemning them because they're tyrants and autocrats and because communism and because whatever socialist management, all these labels that people throw around without really knowing what they're talking about. And you see that now with Venezuela.
Yeah, of course.
Because I don't quite understand how even people who are intelligent and learned and who understand the technology of color revolutions when they are implemented in places like Belarus or Kazakhstan or Georgia or Ukraine and so on, they get it. But when the same thing happens in Venezuela, all of a sudden, they have this cognitive dissonance because Maduro bad, socialism bad, and now suddenly exactly the same playbook is being implemented there, but they're all jumping on the on this narrative of Venezuelan people fighting for freedom against the repressive communist government. Anyway, I think that this default to the shortcut of labels and ideology is keeping us from really understanding. So even let's say maybe we hate the Chinese political system and maybe we hate the Russian political system, but there are certain things that they're doing better than we are. The Chinese lifted 800 million people out of poverty. They have built in the space of about 15 years or less, they've built out tens of thousands of miles of high-speed
38
rail.
38,000 kilometers and counting. They're going to get up to
There you
45.
go, 38,000 kilometers. In the United States, I promise you, I'm 54 years old. I remember from George Bush's first election, which was now 24 years ago, right? When he was running for president, and they were talking about high-speed rail lines, about clean diesel technologies. They were talking about everything that China is actually doing, but none of it was done, and the Chinese did all of it, and they eclipsed the West in the development of their economy and their infrastructure and prosperity for the ordinary Chinese. So why not just go and study what they're doing and then say, well, we like these things and these policies are valid and we should study how to implement them ourselves rather than piling and trash talking over the Chinese and the Russians. I don't understand that, but I did understand through my day job, through my career in the financial markets that groupthink is very real, and it's a very, very powerful driver of conduct and behavior of serious people. And even though it's often very heavily to their detriment, they can't quite rid of, get rid of that groupthink, and they persist in it. And I'm afraid that our policymakers are in the same pitfall, and this is why we're falling way, way, way behind. And they are, you know, they're running the Russians and the Chinese are running circles around us.
Absolutely. Something unimaginable even 5 years ago is happening in Africa. Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso have kicked NATO forces out of their countries. I mean, it's just hard to imagine that this actually happened, and left the Western-backed West African bloc called ECOWAS. Now, this defiant trio has now created a confederation called the Alliance of Sahel States using the French acronym AES. Many people are calling the president of Burkina Faso, Ibrahim Traoré, the 21st century Thomas Sankara. Sankara was the communist leader who led Burkina Faso in 1983 to 1987 before being assassinated by French intelligence, along with 22 other African presidents. I've got the list. However, these three countries were still colonized financially by having as their currency the French Central Bank's franc of the Financial Community of Africa, known by its French acronym CFA. In order to be fully independent and not be financially colonized, they will have to get rid of the CFA. Is it possible? How should these three countries go about doing that? And could the Russian ruble or the Chinese yuan play a role?
Yes, Chinese yuan could play a role, maybe Russian ruble as well. But I think that what's critical there is for those countries to be able to physically defend themselves from Western-sponsored terror gangs, separatist movements, and generally violent extremism, because this is what the West has been using for the past several centuries as means of destabilizing regimes and toppling them and replacing them with something that is better, more to their likings. So these regimes have to be able to defend themselves militarily and to have effective and efficient security forces that can counteract terrorism. Gangs like Boko Haram, which are on remote control of the Western powers, and they're there whenever
Thank
some
you.
government, some
Thank
local,
you. I
yeah,
see.
when some government has to be destabilized, they're right there in the region. And I think this is critical, but I know for a fact that Russia is helping those countries in this sense to be able to prevent those acts of terrorism and color revolutions and assassinations that have been practiced in Africa and elsewhere for centuries, literally. With respect to currency, the problem is that Western policy, which has been basically, you could describe it as neocolonialism, is they have brought all these nations into a relationship where they basically became exporters of raw materials, and they needed to import pretty much everything else. So they were very highly dependent on imports from Western countries for medicine, critical supplies, technology, food staples, refined fuels, things like this. And so the way the Western powers could pretty much blackmail them is that if you dared to maybe trade with your neighboring country and use your own currency, or to sell your export to a country that we don't like Russia or China or somebody like that, well, then we could freeze your accounts, we could block you, we could sanction you, and now suddenly, you can't procure insulin, you can't procure grain. You can't procure fertilizers for your, and now suddenly your people are going hungry. They're going without medicine. They're going without health care. And so now you're starting to get this, how do you call it, political and social pressures that threaten to topple the government. And then you say, like, well, okay, we're gonna trade in US dollars only. We're not gonna sell any of our stuff to the Russians or the Chinese. And then the West, magnanimously says, like, okay, then, we can do business. Just don't get uppity on us anymore, And so I think that for those African countries to be able to break free of this neo-colonial dependency, they had to have, and the West was the one who was selling protection to them, mafia style. It's a nice country you have here. Shame, it would be a shame if something happened to it. I think that Russia came in as the alternative provider of protection services, and this now allows these countries a little bit of maneuvering space to regroup, to reorganize their economies, to trade between themselves, to use their own currencies in their in trade between neighboring states, and to be at least to a degree insulated from Western sanctions. And the West has so extremely abused their this weaponization of sanctions that the whole policy, the whole tactic has become ineffective, and we can see that on the example of Russia, because they threw the worst, most extreme sanctions ever conceived against Russia. And not only did it not destroy Russian economy, but Russian economy is doing much, much better than any of the Western developed economy. I think that this year so far they grew 5%, their GDP, and the United States has barely grown over 2.3, 2.4, 2.4%, if I remember correctly. So, and then also there's the reality that sanctions don't necessarily manage to topple governments in all cases, because you have Cuba, that's been under embargo pretty much since 1958. They're still independent. They still haven't folded before the empire, and Venezuela has been under sanctions for the last 20 years, which are always escalated and increased and made worse.
And North
And
Korea, and North Korea is another good example.
North Korea as well. There you go.
They're not
So,
going anywhere, nor is Iran.
correct.
They just kill,
So, no.
sanctions just kill people. They just kill the citizens. That's all they do. They just kill citizens.
Yes. So, West, I think that the Western arsenal to control all these countries has gone very, very wobbly. And, now they also have to reckon with Russia and China, which are dead serious in their intent to end colonialism once and for all.
Amen. Amen. Well, I just saw an article, Alex. I'm sure you probably saw it too. Apparently, some Wagner soldiers in Mali were killed. There was a terrorist group that attacked their convoy, and I don't know how many they killed, but they actually also got, unfortunately, they got some prisoners too, some Wagner prisoners. So I know Russia's there trying to help this new alliance, the Sahel alliance, to try to fend off these people. And as you say, they're just financed and equipped and by the Western deep state. I mean, when you see the Boko Haram, coming over the horizon with, 50 brand new trucks with rear mounted 50 caliber machine guns, in the bed of the truck in the back, and they're armed to the teeth with AK-47s and hand grenades. That's a lot of money. So, all right. In spite of Saudi Arabia's public warnings, which U.S. Euro billions in external, which owns, I left out a word here, sorry, which owns U.S. Euro billions in external investments and bonds, the European Union is taking a 1,500 million of interest on the seized assets after Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, starting in February of 2022, and it's official. They actually, I saw the headlines. They did do it. Russia has also given stern warnings about using this stolen money, totaling $300 billion in the West. While it is not the principal being used, interest is accrued capital. What do you think is going to happen as a result of this? What could Russia and Saudi Arabia do to show their displeasure?
Okay, so this is a bit more involved because at the moment it would seem that Russia, there's nothing much Russia can do, right? But actually that's a short-sighted view of the problem. Russia will prevail in Ukraine. Russia will dictate their terms of peace.
I agree.
And those terms of peace will pretty much include a capitulation of the Kiev regime. Russia will take over the control of most of Ukraine, certainly all of Ukraine on the east side of the Dnieper River. I
I agree.
think not necessarily by military conquest, but administratively, definitely. Simply, people in power in Kharkov, in Odessa, in Kiev. Will be people who are not part of this extreme right-wing junta that is loyal to Washington and to NATO, and from that point on, we're going to see some reforms in Ukraine, which might even include the reversal of privatizations, where groups like BlackRock and Vanguard and JP Morgan took over Ukraine's energy industry, Ukraine's agricultural land. And that's going to put a very, very significant squeeze on these institutions, but also on the whole Western financial system. And I think that the Russians and the Chinese as well, I think they understand that they can't stop there. They have to carry on. They have to carry on fighting the West. And again, I don't mean that by military means, but it will be by diplomatic and economic means. I think the first thing that's going to have to happen at some point in the near future is that Western jurisdictions are going to have to open up to Russia once more, because they have been shut down by virtue of the so-called Magnitsky Acts. So the Magnitsky Act is a law that was passed through U.S. was lobbied through U.S. Congress in December of 2012, and basically it's ostensibly like a human rights legislation. They pretend that this is a way to sanction companies and government agencies and individuals in Russia who have infringed on people's human rights, people who were guilty of killing this accountant named Sergei Magnitsky. That's why it's called Magnitsky Act. And the man who lobbied this piece of legislation through is a guy named Bill Browder, who used to run the largest foreign-owned hedge fund in Russia during the 1990s. And basically, the whole point of this legislation is to erect a barrier between Western jurisdictions and the Russians, to make it impossible. Because what happened during the 1990s was the greatest, most elaborate pirate raid ever conducted in history of mankind by the West against Russia or
Amen.
any country.
Amen.
So literally hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of dollars of assets were stolen from Russia and taken to the West. And so the Russians have hundreds of files of investigations of illegal activities by Western financiers and their representatives in Russia. And to pursue this theft of assets, they need to go through Western jurisdictions like Cyprus, like New York, like London, Switzerland, Germany, British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands. And so all the jurisdictions where these assets were siphoned through. And so Bill Browder, who participated in this pirate raid against Russia, was tasked by his bosses at the MI6 or CIA or both with lobbying this legislation through the United States. So this is the first law that was passed in through US Congress. But then it was passed through another 30 legislations in the Western world. And so the way I see this conflict continuing is that Russia will put pressure on Western governments one by one to overturn this Magnitsky legislation and to open their judicial systems to Russian court cases and investigations. And at that point, what you have is that the whole legal system gets into play, which then is a machine that, you start interviewing witnesses, participants, you start deposing people. All of this stuff starts to get on the record, documented black and white in legal documents. And I think that in this way, the Russians will be able to trace the stolen asset to their beneficial owners, by name. I don't know, Jacob Rothschild, George Soros, people like that. And then they will demand accountability. They will re demand return of those assets, and they will demand accountability. And those the $300 billion of frozen assets in the West and whatever interest they were supposed to earn on that, that's going to get its turn as well. Already almost 200 years ago, Otto von now his name escapes me. Otto von Bismarck said, "If you're going to be making any kind of a deal with the Russians, make a straight deal. Don't try to cheat because the Russians will eventually come for their due. They, they don't just forget and they don't just forgive." And so I think that all of these legal pursuits, they will probably take a long time. They might take decades, but they're not going to leave them. They're not going to say like, "Oh well, you stole a couple of $1 trillion from us. That's fine. Let's just move on." So, in the short term, it may appear that Russians can do nothing. In the long term, there's going to be hell to pay for this theft.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what happened in the 1990s was the biggest b gang bang. As you said, in the history of the human race, it was just,
Yes.
and the suffering and the death and the poverty and the misery that the Russian people were put through. It's just
Yes.
spectacular what Vladimir Putin has done with that country and working with his people to turn it into a real superpower again.
Yes.
All right. Well, this, in fact, I sent you a link. Apparently, I wrote this question a couple of weeks ago, but apparently, they're really working on this, and have announced that it's going to happen. The BRICS countries are talking about creating a special drawing right slash currency for international trade and financing. Russia, which currently heads the BRICS meetings this year, says they are working on it, but that it is complicated and will take time. Why is it complicated, and why is it so hard to create an SDR currency between countries? That's my first question. And then, until that happens, why is it so difficult to create international payment systems to challenge the West SWIFT? China and Russia have both created cross-border payment systems. The Chinese have their CIPS and the Russians have their SPFS, respectively, but seem to struggle to integrate other countries into the fold. Why the slow uptake? And then why not combine forces and create a Sino-Russian platform? Several years ago, there was talk of a CRIFT, which would be the Chinese-Russian interbank. But it seems to have not advanced. You know why? So basically, two questions: what's going on with BRICS, and what about, which I guess leads us straight into the creating a SWIFT system, at least within BRICS. So let us hear what you have to think.
There was a lot of talk about creating an alternative financial system, basically a replacement for the dollar, a new trade currency and a new reserve currency that would be a common currency of all the participating nations, Russia, China, India, Iran, and so forth, which would be commodity backed, not just gold, but whatever commodities. And then at some point, Sergei Glazyev wrote quite a bit about this. And at one point, not so long ago, maybe a year or two ago, I read an article that he wrote, in which he said, well, actually, none of this is really necessary. Countries can simply use their own currencies to trade between themselves. So we don't need to build a new currency system. This is not an urgent priority. And he didn't quite explain why. He said that it was not necessary. He didn't explain why. But what I believe is, somebody would have to be in charge of this. There would have to be a bureaucracy, an administration in charge of this. And I think that, whoever is managing this system, and you could design some kind of a rotating presidencies and countries, every country having their participant in it, kind of like the IMF. But it still creates the a powerful incentive to game the system, that then some country might try to impose themselves as the arbiter of how things are going to be. And then, if other countries lost confidence in them, it kind of creates a weakness to the whole system. And then countries might be jumping ship and say, you know what, keep your system, we'll go back to the dollar, or we're trading gold or whatever. And so if each country is in charge of their own current account balances and trade and their own currencies, then there isn't a way for anybody to be gaming the whole system. So that's my take. Maybe there are other problems with it, but I just see one of the problem is that you would have to police this. You would have to not only create the currency exchange system, you would also have to police it and administer it and make sure that it's fair and equitable and that nobody's gaming it. And you could do a good job today, but who knows, a decade or two later, there could be different governments and people with different ambitions who would come to power, and maybe the whole system would have the same fate as Bretton Woods. And Bretton Woods, if I'm not mistaken, it has lasted about 15 years, right? The country that was in charge of the system, which again was supposed to be different countries, and there was a, because Bretton Woods, the conference was in 19, I think in 1948, but the system wasn't implemented until I think 1966 or something like this. I'm going with a broad brush, right? Don't quote me on these numbers. And then it fell apart in 1971. No, not 1966, 1956.
56, okay.
And then it fell in 1971. So it was about 15 years that it was in operation. And then Nixon pulled the rug when he ended temporarily the convertibility of the
Temporarily
dollar into,
forever.
yeah, exactly. Convertibility of dollar into gold. So what happened? The United States was in charge of the system. The United States was the one who was supposed to honor the convertibility of dollar to gold, and everybody else was supposed to be trading in the dollar, and so that created an incentive to game the system by the United States, which they did. And then when all the countries started saying, like, hey, you're cheating, I want my take your dollars, I want my gold, then regrettably, to protect the system from speculators and other kind of dishonest player, Nixon had to temporarily suspend the convertibility. And what, 53 years later, they still that temporary period still hasn't expired. So I think that this is why maybe Glazyev thought, we don't need to do any of this. We can just facilitate each nation to trade with other nations in their local currency and then deal with the balance of payments themselves. Easy peasy.
Well, it seems to be working because you read all these articles about Iran trading with Russia in local currencies, and China trading with Russia, and India trading with Russia, and so this Asian bloc, Saudi Arabia, trading in its currency, and so apparently the local currency thing is working. I don't know how they hedge against currency volatility and currency fluctuation, but apparently it's working. So at least for some of the countries, some of the time.
Oh, yeah, it should work in the long term. Currencies are going to fluctuate, they are going to be volatile. And sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. That's a normal course of business. You can buy gold today, and tomorrow they might knock it down $100 an ounce, which just happened a few weeks ago. That's a normal course of business. Nothing is guaranteed, nothing is can be cemented. Everything flows and fluctuates, but at least countries are not beholden to some hegemon who tells them, well, you may trade with these people, but not with those people. And I think that the best illustration of colonial relationship was exactly one of the Sahel countries, being Niger, sorry. And Niger was selling its uranium ore to France at $1 a kilo, when the market price was between $100 and $200 a kilo, and so how do you maintain that relationship? That somebody there doesn't say like, well, we'd actually like $2 a kilo, thank you very much, and the French say like, no, you get one and be happy. Well, you do it by making it impossible for them to trade any other way, and if they do. There's assassination squads, there's NGOs that can engineer a color revolution and so forth. And then there's also financial sanctions where you say like, well, okay, guess what? You have all this money in our central bank, and you were going to use it to buy insulin for your people and to buy how do you call it, fertilizers for your farmers. Well, guess what? We're freezing your account, so no insulin, no fertilizers, no energy for you. And then you have like, okay, well, thank you very much. We'll take that $1. Thank you. That's very generous. But so I think that what's going on today is that after several centuries, this system is coming to an end.
I
And I
agree.
think that the whole of humanity is
I agree.
transitioning to something that's a complete discontinuity with respect to everything we've known for the last, I would say, 500 years at least.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
I think it's a good change, and I think that it's going to be humanity collectively coming out at the end of the tunnel.
Well, Alex, with people like you out there informing thousands of people around the world about the what's really going on in the financial world, and all of your amazing background and experiences, I am sure that this show will make some people wake up and change their minds if they had any preconditioned assumptions about the greatness of of Western finance vis-a-vis the rest of the world. So thank you so much for being on the show.
It's a great pleasure, Jeff. Thank you for having me. And once more, warm greetings from Croatia to your viewers and listeners.
Absolutely. And I will Alex has written books. He's got a website. He's got a Substack. I even cross-posted one of his Substacks recently. I was so impressed with it. It really resonated with me. Did you know I did that, Alex? Did you, I cross-posted one of your?
No, I did. I didn't. I didn't.
Sorry,
But
don't worry about it. It was about Yugoslavian communism, but anyway, I loved it.
Oh, right. Okay, yes.
because it really, really resonated with me. And anyway, he's got a website, and he's also got financial services. I will put all of that on the website page for his interview. And again, thank you very much, Alex. I will give you a Buddhist bow and wish you all the best. And I hope this isn't our last interview together. So take care.
For
Bye-bye.
sure. Take care. Thank you, Jeff. Bye.
How do I turn off? I think that's